I'm Femi Oke. Today on the stream, we cross the globe to bring you timely updates on three important stories that we've covered in the past. If you're watching us on YouTube, thank you. Help me ask the questions that you want answers to by using the comment section and joining today's conversation. We begin in Tanzania, where police have been trying to forcibly remove thousands of indigenous Maasai from their ancestral land.
We are saying no! No to violations of human rights! People in Tanzania are dying! Women are being raped! Children are getting lost! And you arrest us! Why? We are the Maasai! We are not agreeing!
We are joined by Joseph Olushange, a human rights lawyer and member of the Maasai. Joseph, welcome back to the stream. Good to have you. I'm going to remind our audience the last time that we spoke to you on the stream. Have a look here on my laptop right here. The story that we did, and this was back in February. Have a look here on my laptop. Join me, everybody. Here we go. Tanzania's Maasai facing eviction. Why are Tanzania's Maasai being forced off their ancestral land? That was the 26th of February of this year. Now we're seeing violent evictions. Can you remind us what the problem is with Maasai living on their own ancestral land, Joseph?
OK, thank you very much for having me here again for the second time now. What's happening and why the Maasai are being evicted is, and I have said in the earlier interview, is the loss of money, is the loss of dollars. The government is so much eager in getting so much of the money, disregarding the human right, disregarding the law, disregarding the court orders. Because when we talk in February, we are saying of whether there will be a worse scenario or no. Now we are in one. We are in one where the government deployed the military, so to say, to force the demarcations of the Maasai lands, not only contrary to Tanzanian law, not only disregarding their rights, but contrary to the East African Court of Justice order in 2018 that directed the government not to interfere with that pending the issuance of the final verdict of the court, which has not been issued today, actually rescheduled to September.
Joseph, I don't want to get too deep into a court case, but basically you're saying what the government is doing is has not been legally decided yet, and yet they're still doing the evictions. I want to show our audience what those evictions are like, to hear the stories of the people who have been evicted. Let's take a look. This is a Maasai elder from earlier on this month.
We are here and we are tired. We ran away, the three of us, and we were ambushed by the military. I can say it was the military. They got out of their vehicles and started beating us. I personally tried to plead with them. My fellow Tanzanians, do not kill us. Why are you killing us? This land belongs to our grandparents.
Joseph, the government has denied that they are forcibly evicting people violently. They are saying that there have been clashes with the police, that the Maasai have been fighting the authorities, not the other way round. Where is the truth in this matter?
The truth of this matter is very simple to know. On 6, 7 and 8, the government deployed the military. And actually, after a few days, the regional commissioner told the chief of defense forces that we have the Tanzania People Defense Forces operation in Loliondo and Ngorongoro. Now what happens, and you can see on the footage, it is the military attacking the people, the life bullets. Because I'm a Maasai, I can hear some of the voices, for example, some guy saying, can we retaliate now? We are tired being haunted. And some are saying, no, do not kill the people. Do not fire the arrows. But now what happens, because the government is saying there is no violence, what happened? On 10th and 11th to date, there has been a military operation in Loliondo. 31 people has been seriously wounded. More than 1,000 people has crossed the border. And unfortunately, one of them actually is the one I have seen in the video. Mm-hmm. The old man was also injured in that operations. And we have 25 people now in detention. They were detained without having access to lawyers nor the family for over 10 days. So it is not the Maasai actually fighting the governments. They do not have those muscles anyway to fight against them. It was, of course, some sort of resistance that this is our land. You cannot demarcate our lands contrary to law. And the court has said they were right. It was the government that was in the wrong end. But there is violence. I know the government is denying that fact. They are saying those are the Kenyans' people. But how on earth do you say, okay, can you even engage the Kenyan now authority and tell them what's happening on the other side of the border? What they are doing now, actually, they are saying they are undertaking an operations to search for people they call foreigners. It now turned out to be anyone speaking up is being named as
Joseph,
a foreigner.
All right, Joseph, let me just share a couple of things for you that I'm seeing on YouTube right now. Susanna, the illegal beacons on Loliondo must be uprooted. Illegal beacons. Can you explain what illegal beacons are very quickly, Joseph?
Oh, it is illegal. Yeah, she was describing about the borderlines that the government has. Actually, on 17th, they gazetted a game control area. They call it Pololet. Yeah. Why are we saying it is illegal?
Okay.
It is illegal because it was made without consulting the local authorities and the village people.
I hear you. Let me move on, because I wanted to do one more quick point here from YouTube, so people can talk to you as well. Jay Shetty says, shame on the Tanzanian government for forcing the indigenous Maasai from their land. This will incite civil war. I want to get one more thought in here, Joseph, and this is from Roland Ebole from Amnesty International. How do you solve this impasse? This is what Roland said earlier.
We want the authorities in Tanzania to halt the ongoing demarcation process and the security operation in Loliondo. And we want the government to begin genuine consultation with the Maasai community.
So, Joseph, while this matter is with the courts, what happens to Maasai communities? Are they still in danger of being evicted from their land?
Not in danger, actually. After demarcations, the operation from tens to almost 20, according to the government, they issued a 24-hour notice that everyone living, lawfully living with that land, 1,500 square kilometers, should vacate the place within 24 hours.
Okay.
And many people vacated the place almost overnight. You can see people like putting their things on donkeys and others to travel out of that land. Right. And those who were found, the cows, the donkeys, and the sheep, has been shot dead last week for being found to be staying in the land now contested, which I was saying was declared a game control area contrary to law.
We're going round in circles,
almost
Joseph.
Almost 40,000 people.
We're going round in circles. I appreciate what it must be like for you to work on this issue. Thank you so much for coming back to the stream and helping us understand what is going on. Joseph Olashange, on Twitter, you can follow Joseph. He's at Olashange. Thank you so much for joining us. We move north now to Libya, where hope for a better life is vanishing for around 600,000 migrants who are stranded there. According to a new report by Doctors Without Borders, a majority of refugee and asylum seekers are, I'm going to quote here, victims of arbitrary detention, torture and violence, including sexual violence.
We commonly see stab wounds, bullet wounds, burns even. We've seen evidence of electrocution. Lots of beatings with whips and hoses and things like that.
Here to discuss the report and what needs to be done to protect migrants in Libya, we have Steve Pubrick. Steve is the Libya coordinator for Doctors Without Borders. Hello, Steve. We have been following migrants and their fates going through Libya for several years now. What does this latest report from Doctors Without Borders tell us that is new?
In fact, it shows us what we've learned since we started working on migration inside Libya in 2016. And what we see as a medical organisation, fundamentally migrants who are extremely vulnerable and extremely exposed to abuse inside Libya. And what that means is, firstly, in the official detention system, where they're liable to be arbitrarily detained, forced to pay a ransom to be released, And then we see in the trafficking warehouses where many migrants are trapped on their way into Libya, or even when they once they're inside Libya and they are kidnapped, beaten, tortured, as you heard from my colleague Mohammed there, and forced to pay ransoms to get out. It is effectively industrial scale trafficking. What we find as doctors is that we have no safe place to discharge our patients. We can provide physical medical care and we can attempt to provide some mental health care. But once these cases have been treated by us, we have no safe option for some of the most vulnerable cases. They are not safe inside Libya. And the reason we are calling for evacuations is because it's the only form of protection that is viable for these cases.
I'm thinking about the organisation Doctors Without Borders. You are so careful about treating everybody who needs treatment, wherever they happen to be, whatever the circumstances. But I feel that this report is saying these circumstances are not sustainable. We have to change these circumstances. Are you stepping up and speaking out?
Exactly. We've probably become normalised to the situation inside Libya over the course of the years. And what we are saying now is the existing mechanisms to protect some of these more vulnerable migrants and refugees just aren't functioning. The systems that are in place for resettlements are far too slow and they're too restrictive. There are many migrants who need international protection, or other refugees who need international protection, who are not eligible simply for registration inside Libya. What we are saying is that we have seen examples of evacuation corridors work from Libya and from other countries, and we know that is the best option to provide protection for these people. The reason we are calling for evacuations in particular is because they can be much faster and much quicker. And it's because if we discharge a patient who's recovered from torture, who's recovered from tuberculosis, which is effectively a disease of detention, and we have no safe place to discharge that case, that person, that migrant, is at risk of being re-trafficked, at risk of being, if they're a woman and they are in a trafficking warehouse, they're at extreme risk of sexual violence. And we have dozens and dozens of testimonies over the years demonstrating this. We have no safe place to refer them. The only option for these most vulnerable cases is evacuation through an expedited process.
Right. Steve, I'm going to show our audience some of the migrants and hear from some of their own experiences of what it's like to be in Libya. Let's have a listen. Let's have a look.
I'm entering the Libya by catching by traffickers. The traffickers beating electricity something. Looks my face, first of all, and my hands.
Well, in Libya, there is so much human violence, like capturing people from their meal camps, taking them to the prison, trying to ask them money. So it's difficult.
Steve, to take those migrants out of the situation that they're in, isn't that a huge operation, multinational operation?
So at the moment, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, runs evacuations of resettlements, and some evacuations from Libya, but with very small numbers. Last year, it was around 1,600 people were taken out of the country. And the International Organization for Migration does some voluntary repatriations from detention and from Libya back to countries of origin. What we as Médecins Sans Frontières are asking for is that European governments in particular, but governments step up and do their part to provide international protection for some of these most exceptional cases. There are at least 600,000 migrants inside Libya, but a lot of them are there for work. The Libyan economy depends on migrant labour. But amongst that cohort, there are refugees and there are other migrants who are exceptionally vulnerable, who have been trafficked, have been re-trafficked, have attempted to cross the Mediterranean and been intercepted and forcibly returned to Libya, where they end up in a detention centre. And then we see them again. This is a cycle of violence and it's not changing. We are not saying necessarily that of all these 600,000 people in fact need to be evacuated. But there is certainly a cohort that is much larger than the current group who are getting out of Libya.
This is an interesting question. It's one that I thought about quite a lot. But on YouTube, Escobar is saying, why are people still going to Libya after hearing all of these stories? But it basically means the push factors are more important than anything else. The fact is that making the... I'm answering the question myself. Steve, I have you here to do that.
I know. So. Yeah,
it always bugs me. I was like, why would you go? But I know, because if you're hungry, if you have no hope, you might as well go. Steve, go ahead. Give me an added thought on that.
No, what's wanting to say? You're absolutely right. There are the fact that people fleeing violence in their home countries is certainly a key factor, or who cannot seek protection in their home country as well, and they come to Libya. As I said before, a lot of people coming to Libya are coming as economic migrants. They make the journey overland, they return overland. But amongst some of those also are extreme cases of violence and trafficking. And you heard from some of the interviewees earlier of beatings, of rape, of burns, electric shocks, and so on. People detained in conditions for months, if not years. So these are, for people who are coming, many people don't have a choice, and many people come for other reasons, not expecting to see this level of violence. Mm-hmm.
I've got one more thought and one more voice to add to this conversation. It comes from Mark Kay, who's from the International Rescue Committee. This is what he told us a little bit earlier.
This isn't just a problem of Libya's making. We are a global community, and we need to be doing more to ensure that this group are supported. And that can be seen, you know, with the EU and other states doing more to resettle these people who are increasingly vulnerable in Libya. We'd also love to see the EU do more to ensure that proper search and rescue missions are occurring in the Central Med to prevent further completely preventable loss of life.
I'm going to leave our conversation there, Steve. Have a look at my laptop, everybody. I want you to see the report from Médecins Sans Frontières. That's Doctors Without Borders, right here on my laptop, so you can go and check it out yourself. Let me just remind you what it is called. Out of Libya, Opening Safe Pathways for Vulnerable Migrants Stuck in Libya. The UNHCR has actually just recently flown out migrants from Libya for a safe corridor. So some action is happening. Steve, thank you for drawing this to our attention. He's the Advocacy Manager for Doctors Without Borders. And now to the fallout following the United States Supreme Court's decision to reverse Roe versus Wade. Until last week, the landmark case had granted women the constitutional right to an abortion. The court's reversal has made women's reproductive rights and healthcare the sole jurisdiction of individual states. Let me welcome to this conversation Amy Howe, a reporter at SCOTUS Blog. Hello, Amy. Goodness me, it was such a week on Friday. You could feel America's feelings, emotions, regardless of what they felt about abortion, abortion rights. Everybody was talking about it all the way through the weekend and even now. If you could explain to an international audience what the reversal of Roe versus Wade means for the United States, what would you say?
Sure. So as you noted, the Supreme Court in the 1970s and then again in 1992 ruled that there is a constitutional right to abortion. And the Supreme Court last Friday, in a case called Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, said in essence that those two decisions, Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, were wrong, and that they were so wrong that the Supreme Court was going to take the step of overruling them. There is a concept in American law called stare decisis, which is the idea that courts should not overturn their past decisions unless there's a good reason to do so, to give a sense of stability and legitimacy. But the court in this case said, we are going to overturn Roe and Casey. They were wrong. There was not and is not now a right to right under the Constitution to an abortion. They said abortion is a profound moral choice that should be left up to the states, the people's representatives. And so now the issue, as you said, does go back to the 50 states for individual states to decide what restrictions, if any, they want to place on abortions.
I'm thinking about immediate reactions and immediate actions. Some states are ready to make very strict abortion laws. Some states are ready to push back from very strict abortion laws. Can you talk about that split for us, Amy?
That's right. Some states have been anticipating this for some time and have what are known as trigger laws, which were laws that were already on the books in states and that would go with the idea that they would go into effect if the Supreme Court were to overrule Roe and Casey. And so right now there's litigation ongoing in some states about whether or not these laws can go into effect. In Florida, for example, and in Kentucky, there's been litigation about whether or not, even if the U.S. Constitution does not protect a right to an abortion, the individual states' constitutions might. So there's litigation with that. And then the flip side of that, as you said, is that in some states like California and Illinois that are Democratic strongholds, where there's not really a question of the right to an abortion being in jeopardy, but officials in those states, some of them have talked about taking action because they anticipate that women in states where abortion is banned or is difficult will come to their states in the hope of obtaining an abortion. Mm-hmm. And so states like California want to make sure that they have enough doctors to perform the abortions that women may come to them for.
Earlier on the stream, we asked Dr. Tani Malhotra to share her thoughts and feelings about what stage America is in right now in terms of access to abortion. And this is what she told us.
Pregnancy is inherently risky, and the recent SCOTUS decision and the subsequent enactment of the heartbeat bill in Ohio puts patients, pregnant patients in Ohio, at further risk, both physically and mentally. We know that patients who are in abusive or unsafe relationships see an increase in violence during pregnancy, and forcing them will increase that risk. But more importantly, patients who find out that they have a lethal anomaly in their baby or have a baby has a problem that's not compatible with life are now going to be forced to continue these pregnancies. I cannot begin to imagine what the mental health impact of that is going to look like for the future of Ohio.
So, Amy, these are very real concerns, and so many have come up, not just since Friday, but in the lead up to Friday, because people were anticipating that this may be the case, that abortion rights in terms of federal law may disappear. I would love you to help us understand the celebratory mood, though, amongst the lobby that was very happy that abortion is no longer in the hands of federal law, but goes to states to decide. Joyful. I remember I was on social media and praise the Lord and hashtag praise God were trending. Can you talk to us about that side of the debate?
Certainly. So interestingly, when Roe versus Wade was first issued in the early 1970s, there was not a big reaction to it. But over the years, the issue of abortion has become a very polarizing issue in the United States. And many people, particularly social conservatives, people who are very religious, strongly believe that abortion is an abomination. And this has been a big political movement for many years. Many people attribute the abortion issue in no small part to the election of President Donald Trump back in 2016. When he was running for office in 2015 and 2016, he pledged to put justices on the Supreme Court who would be pro-life, he said, who would automatically overrule Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And there were many people, I think, who were suspicious of Donald Trump when he was running for office. He'd supported Democratic candidates in the past. You know, he'd been married three times, and social conservatives were suspicious. But he put out a list of judges who he would nominate to the Supreme Court if he were elected. And I think that helped to convince many people to vote for him. And they saw this decision last Friday as the culmination of years of efforts.
Amy Howe, thank you so much. Amy Howe is from the SCOTUS blog. I highly recommend that you follow it. They have some latest news and they had a couple of scoops in the last few days. Thank you so much, Amy Howe. Let me just see what you're saying here on YouTube. Yumran Chehi says, I think that this will just increase the numbers of unsafe abortions. And why not give people the right to choose if they're able to terminate their own pregnancy? That is a big why. And the United States continues to debate that even now. Thank you so much to all of our guests today for the three stories that we covered. I'll see you next time. Take care.